Now we're recording.
Oh, great. Hello. Yes, how are you doing there?
Well, put your mic in front of your mouth.
I will. Yo, mic. Get on the mic, my man. I'm listening. You can speak.
Well, I was in the States last week.
Speak into the microphone. John Ashton, ladies and gentlemen. Yes. He's a good man. Is he still alive? I hope so. Any idea on John Ashton? Are you on the internet there?
I don't know.
You would know John Ashton. Everyone knows John Ashton, as they should. Anyway.
I'm just trying to look through our texts to see some things that we said we wanted to talk about.
Oh, okay.
In the meantime, I got a new crown yesterday at the dentist. It was pretty awful.
The Tondarts.
Mm-hmm.
The tooth doctor.
Because I've clenched my teeth so hard for so long that I am pretty much eating my own teeth. Like I'm little flicks of enamel or like flicking off of my teeth, like so much clading on a not very well designed British estate.
So much clading.
Isn't it clading?
It is in the other ones. It's cladding, I think.
Cladding.
I mean, but yeah, this clothing, it's all the same idea, ain't it? Yes, that's bad news when you're, but you have a mouth guard you can use for that sort of thing, right? However, your not your specifically one's teeth move, right? So the mouth guard does not fit as well as it used to, correct? I mean, this is a night guard, right?
Oh yeah, here we go. Okay, so I flew very briefly to Detroit and Chicago via Aer Lingus Dublin.
Yeah.
And the Dublin International Airport has a unique relationship with U.S. Customs where you can actually go through U.S. Customs in the Dublin Airport so that when you land in the U.S., you can just sail right on through. That's sort of nice.
Nice.
And so I fly into Chicago and I'm in baggage claim. And there's in baggage claim a big vending machine, a CVS vending machine. And CVS is a drugstore, or what we call in the Netherlands, an apotheek.
Apothecary.
And yep. So among the selection of car sickness pills and toothbrushes and what else? You know,
condoms.
Yeah, and ibuprofen.
Sure.
In the first row, the upper left corner, the first row, you can buy from a vending machine fentanyl. Nope, not fentanyl, Narcan.
I was going to say.
Narcan. Just in case you or someone you might pass by on the street is overdosing on fentanyl.
Oh, that's really one out to... Okay, but that must be an over-the-counter... Well, excuse me, it's...
Well, it didn't used to be.
Whatever.
Only EMTs would carry it, but now so many people are overdosing all over the place. Why not keep some fentanyl? Or God, I keep doing that. Keep some Narcan with you, you know, just in case.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I mean, that's the country now.
And it's actually effective at bringing people out of... Or
like immediately.
Stabilizing them.
In a Tarantino sort of...
Okay. You know? Yeah.
Oh, that hurt.
Be careful. Jeez. Yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, we were joking in a very not funny way. It's sort of a missed merchandising opportunity to not also include the fentanyl. People who bought this also bought that. You know how that goes.
Yeah. I don't know how that works.
And this was sort of, this was very me, but I strategically booked a window seat in the bulkhead so I'd have all that extra leg room.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in the bulkhead, you have to put for takeoff and landing all of your stuff, because there is no sliding your backpack in the seat in front of you. There's no seat in front of you. You have to put everything up above.
Yes.
So I was putting everything up above, but of course all of the overhead compartments were already filled up. And so I said to the flight attendant, she just was like walking away from me. I'm like, but I can't, there is no, what am I supposed to do? There is no overhead. Right. Everything's full. And she goes, look behind you. And I looked behind me and pretty much the entire plane was completely empty. And I'm like, oh, is it going to stay this way? She's like, yeah, yeah. So I'm like, oh, wow, cool. So of course, everyone's moving around. The plane was so empty that everyone who wanted, you know, four across in the middle to themselves could have one.
This is Dublin to Detroit or Dublin to Chicago?
Dublin to Chicago.
Dublin to Chicago. It was still very empty. And yeah. This was like midday. This wasn't insanely early or late,
no.
Right?
No.
Okay.
But interesting. It was still really uncomfortable because, you know, you still have like the you're trying to stretch out. You're yep. still having all the seat belts and stuff kind of digging into you. But on this airline.
It's an Airbus or Boeing. Do you know?
I think it was. I don't know. But on this, I think, I don't know. But the armrests on these planes don't go all the way up. They only go maybe like 3/4 of the way up.
Mm-hmm.
They don't stay up. So they all the you would have to like wiggle your body underneath all the armrests, and then they all come slamming down on you.
Right.
So you're trying to sleep with these armrests on you. It was sort of it was very anticlimactic. I still wasn't able to get any good rest. You know, still very loud. That is
unfortunate. Yep. Yeah. And you were trying out some new travel pillows and whatnot.
Well,
right?
I have my travel pillow routine down perfect now. So I have those two. What's the name of that loop? Like it's an infinite.
The Mobius strip.
Mobius strip. I have two Mobius strip pillows, which are super comfortable because you could kind of create like a sling for your arms if you put it around your neck.
I was going to say, they're actually just like loops, right? They're just sewn together. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But right. So you twist around.
And then I have this really great neck pillow. That has this sort of like elephant trunk that comes around the front. That's the key. And that's very comfortable. Like I think we talked about on the last podcast, the whole trick to being comfortable trying to sleep upright is to get your arms sort of level with your chest and have them resting there comfortably.
Yes. And you also experimented with the rigid. Something had like a kind of a plastic to give you support
really
with the neck.
Work.
Okay, that does not work.
The other thing for me that's key is to somehow get my knees above my hip bones. So I wear my like stacked sneakers or I might put my feet on my very stuffed backpack as sort of a footrest.
Mm-hmm.
That's helpful too.
Well, I think with the, if you have a fairly empty plane, then you should be able to sit behind a seat. You sit behind an empty seat, mm-hmm. right? And then you can, if you know that the seat in front of you isn't reclined, you can try the, leaning forward to sleep. Mm-hmm. I find that pretty comfortable. Sometimes even on the tray table.
Yeah, that can be helpful too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing that we need to catch up on is a little factoid, adorable factoid, really, in history that you discovered on DutchNews.nl, that the tram company.
Oh, yeah, it's controversial. You don't want to talk about this.
We do. But not for the seriousness of it. We have to take it up a level.
Right.
But the National Tram Service was quasi-commandeered by the Nazis to transport Jewish people to the train stations as they would be eventually taken off to concentration camps where they would be murdered.
So when you say commandeered, it's actually...
Well, I said quasi because the tram company was still charging the Nazis for the service
contract.
It was a service contract.
Yeah.
So... Now, there was a proper Dutch resistance, and that was noble and honorable and brave and true. However, this whole morbid story is about the Dutch mentality. After the war was over, the Dutch tram company.
Tram company has a couple years of unpaid invoices.
Very, very aggressively pursued the Nazis.
Yeah, in 47 and 48.
To shake them down.
Still going after, yes.
For unpaid invoices.
Right, right, yeah.
The Dutch will shake you down repeatedly if you accidentally, you know, if your invoice was 47 euros and you maybe saw it wrong and paid 41 euros, they will track you down.
Well, and actually, hadn't some of them, in fact, been turned over to collection agencies by then? And, you know, standard collection agency mentality is, well, you know, we don't care what the circumstances are surrounding the debt. The fact is, there's a debt and we're here to collect on the debt. So the fact that it was about transporting folks to the East, and who the parties were, doesn't concern the collection agency.
So there's another piece of this story where I believe I have to review this, but I believe there was, yeah, here we go. In 2005, Dutch railway company NS apologized for its role in Nazi death camp transports, and in 2019 paid out millions of euros in compensation to Holocaust survivors or next of kin. Now,
and that's the trains, not the trams.
Now, but, this yeah. now the operative word here is the N in NS, which stands for Nationale. Yep. So it's a government-owned public transportation system.
Yep.
Which is supported by tax dollars. So what that means in essence is that the Holocaust survivors or next of kin who are citizens of the Netherlands paying into the tax system were compensated basically with their
probably
own money.
With some of their own money. Yeah.
So that's good. Course, that worked out great for everyone. Good job.
I think NS is partly privately owned now, isn't it? I think. But I'm not certain about that. It might be entirely, but no, it's still called the National Rail Service, and some of it is still publicly owned. Yeah, that's stay classy, Netherlands.
Minister set up secret operation to keep ASML in the Netherlands. Here's another thing that's top of mind among many in the Netherlands is the 30% ruling.
Yep.
So the 30% ruling is a giant tax break that is awarded to knowledge workers coming into the Netherlands. Yeah. And what it means is that 30% of your income is not taxable. So it has like a double benefit. First of all, you get 30% of your income tax-free, but then... So the government sort of pretends that like your salary therefore is 30% lower than it actually is, which puts you in potentially into a lower tax bracket. Now probably doesn't happen that often because there's like a minute, actually probably never happens because there's like a minimum amount of salary that you need to be paid before
to
you
be
can...
a so-called knowledge worker. Yeah.
Yeah. So it used to be that anybody. So the way that it worked, because I got the 30% ruling when I first moved here, is that the company had to show that they'd been looking for somebody to hire within the EU and the Netherlands for 6 months. And if they couldn't, then they could go outside of the EU or the Netherlands for very specialized skills. So it was a pretty loose. And then you would get the 30% ruling for 7 years or 10 years or whatever it was. I think seven years. It was 7 years. And it was also good retroactively because if you started working and the paperwork wasn't done yet, once you are awarded the 30%, then you get like this sort of bonus of the compensation that was owed to you.
Right.
So now the Dutch government sort of clamping down on that. It's only 5 years. Knowledge workers have to be extremely esoteric in their skill set. So you have to be like a quantum physicist or whatever. And now they're thinking about maybe doing away with it altogether. So interestingly, people in the startup community are very frustrated by this because they're like, there's not enough talent in this tiny country. Yep. We really need to be able to incentivize people. I always felt uncomfortable receiving the 30% ruling because I knew that my take-home pay was considerably higher than my peers at the company. I mean, I'm not going to say no to extra money, but right. I felt a little guilty about it. I felt a little sheepish about it. And well, I knew
part,
that
they were upfront about it. They too. Were really they knew exactly annoyed. What was going
yeah.
on. Yeah.
But I also think that there's so many benefits to living in the Netherlands versus anywhere where a knowledge worker might be coming from. I really do question if the 30% ruling isn't a bit over the top, isn't even necessary, you know?
Well, and they were talking about doing away with that. I think Omtzigt, among others, was, you know, saying, okay, well, it's time to get rid of it. Then, of course, many of the multinationals that benefit from it said, okay, well, if you're going to do away with it, we're pulling up stakes. And then immediately they say, oh, well, now wait a second. Let's not get crazy here. Let's talk about modifying it a bit. You know, it's the old, you know, we would like a new stadium for our sports team. If the city's not going to basically make it extremely attractive for us to build here, we'll take the franchise elsewhere. So naturally, your many multinationals were doing that. So I think that the government has backtracked on that now. Well, it's not even the government. I mean, we have no government, of course, here. While Rutte, you know, lets the clock run on his last cabinet before he assumes Stoltenberg's job at NATO. But yes, in the meantime, some of the key players, such as that shit with Peter Omtzigt, he was saying, oh, yeah, let's get rid of this 30% rule. Anyway, as soon as things got ugly, he backtracked.
Yeah. Okay, well, so.
Yep.
Without the, you know, insulting.
Oh, sorry. I'm sure he's a fine man.
And, okay, well, you don't know him, but. But yes,
I don't need to know him. ASML. I know what he does.
ASML, yeah. A company that very few people know about. And this is so incredibly Dutch.
Yeah.
It's one of the most important companies in the world. There's only one other company in the world that does what ASML does. And so the way I understand this, and you'll be able to clarify this for me, is that 90% of all microchips are made in Taiwan. The quality control testing, which is absolutely critical for microchips, is done by this company, ASML. So all of the world's microchips, for the most part, all come through ASML for this quality control processing, and then they get sold on everywhere else. So indeed, again, referring to Dutch news, the CEO, Peter Vennick of ASML, is very concerned about this, about the 30% ruling problems, because he says that the tax cut granted to some workers brought in from abroad other plans mooted by the parties in talks on forming a right-wing government, such as reducing the number of highly skilled migrants coming to the Netherlands from outside the EU, are also regarded as a serious problem. The shortage of housing is also an issue.
Sure.
However, the 30% ruling can backfire. Because a lot of people who would prefer to stay here have built themselves up a lifestyle that after 5 years, 7 years, whenever it ends, is now beyond their means. And then they leave the country.
Yep.
So now you've, you know, no doubt spent all of this money bringing this person over, paying for the relocation services, getting them set up, and then after just a few years, they leave because they decide they can no longer afford to live here in the way that they have become accustomed.
Right, right.
There's just got to be a better way than dangling the money carrot in front of people to get them to come to the Netherlands. It's plenty nice and wonderful living here without it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Or just pay people more. Pay everybody more. How about that? Just pay everybody the same. Pay everybody more.
Sure. Yeah, free everything for everyone.
I just don't think it's fair for the Dutch knowledge workers who are qualified to work at these companies, but they get paid less.
Well, there's a lot of issues here, and they're certainly not unique to the Netherlands. I think baked into that is a lot of the unexamined, assertion that, well, part of the reason we need these incentive programs is because we don't have the talent here. We can't attract the talent. Now, that almost always means we don't want to pay local talent. So, you know, this whole idea, we saw it certainly in the U.S. So it's, oh, well, we need, you know, more H-1B visas or whatever, because, you know, we just don't, American workers just can't do this. It's like, oh, let me guess, South Asians can do it at one third or one half the salary. It's like, oh, well, yeah, they can. Okay. I mean,
but
it's ridiculous.
In America.
Of course. No, I'm saying the reason that you have these sorts of visa programs is that whole idea. It's like, well, we don't have the talent here. It's like, no, you're not willing to pay the talent there. Of course you have the talent. Everyone has the capability of learning anything. Now, people have, you know, there are some natural inclinations, you know, broad strokes, whatever. I like math, or I don't like math. I like English. I don't like English, whatever. Or, you know, literature, whatever. But no, everyone's capable of everything. So whether you have sufficient incentives in place to, you know, attract that talent, that's an entirely separate issue. Anyway, yeah, these are big topics. Also, I think, by the way, I don't know the numbers. Yes, you have companies like ASML, which I think, in very general terms, you could say, and I'm only pointing this out because it seems so Dutch to me. It's like, oh, so you guys make the chips? No, we don't make the chips. We don't know anything about making the chips. We make the machines that make the chips. So it's just that very Dutch sort of supply chain. It's like, without other companies to make the chips, there's nobody to use the machines that make the chips. And it's just like Dutch, you know, it's a, wait, so you guys, you have slavery? No, we don't have slavery. We don't discourage slavery because, you know, without somebody to, you know, be involved in the slave trade, you know, we wouldn't have customers. But no, we're not partaking ourselves. Anyway.
Yeah, and a lot of these assumptions from Tech Leap or the business community are objectively incorrect. I mean, these sorts of studies have been done over and over again, especially with younger people who don't put a premium on salary versus, say, job satisfaction or freedom or vacation days.
Yep.
So Tech Leap has expressed its fears about the business climate. This guy, Hamed Sadegian, chief executive, Nearfield Instruments, told a Financiële Dagblad some 40% of his workforce and 40% of his workforce of 170 employees use the 30% ruling.
Yeah.
He says, we need them because there is not enough talent available, he said. Sure. Here. At the end of the day, you look at the paycheck. Well, that's not true in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
And again, I always thought at Microsoft, everybody there is so coddled and so overcompensated. Yep. It's one of the reasons why it's really hard to leave, because although it's not, because you're never in the Netherlands going to get paid more than, you know, at a multinational corporation than you are at someplace like Microsoft. But we had a 200 euro a month allowance for coffee that just went into your paycheck.
Right.
You got a compensation for a luxury lease car. Some of us got the 30% ruling.
Get it back either if you brought your own coffee either.
It was just money to use.
Yeah.
You know, you get huge amounts of vacation days all paid. I was like, I don't pay for anything.
Right.
You know, and I don't need you to give me $200 a month for coffee. I can pay for my coffee. And I could never quite figure out with the car allowance, you either lease a car and then you just lease the car, or if you don't lease the car, the leasing allowance goes back into your paycheck just as income. So I'm like, I don't need a car. So I used that money to pay for my mortgage.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was crazy. It was too much money.
Well, I mean, also,
plus stock options. Yeah.
Again, you know, we're talking about these things in such general terms that maybe they're not even meaningful. But I think sometimes that whole conversation about, oh, you know, we just can't find the people here, we can't attract the talent, whatever, I think sometimes, though I've never heard it put this explicitly, simply means that, in the case of the Netherlands, Dutch people just don't work hard enough. I need people who have a different attitude about work. And, you know, we've lived in both worlds, again, generalizations, plenty of exceptions both directions. But Americans work much, much harder than Europeans. And if you actually want to build that, you know, American work culture, whatever, there's larger issues about whatever work-life balances and, you know, health and what should a society be this, you know, fuck everyone else and race to the top. But it exists. And I think there are plenty of companies, especially with younger founders, who want that same work attitude in Europe. And it's not part of the culture. So you're going to have to bring people along or convince locals that you're trying to do something differently.
It's been my observation that British people that work for giant corporations are as work obsessed as mm-hmm. Americans. It was also my observation that Dutch people do work very hard, and you're going to see them putting in, you know, 50 hours a week, 60 is pushing it.
Yeah.
They work very hard, but they're not work obsessed. Their identity isn't wrapped up in their right. work, which is, I think, very healthy. Mm-hmm. I would like to see more women in the workplace working full time, but you know what? I think that's a value judgment. There's a reason why Dutch kids are some of the happiest in the world. And then you've got the French who are just like, would you guys please just go to work a little bit? Just go work a little while. Just work. Just go to work. Come on.
The answer is
That they're a bit ridiculous, but I don't think it has so much to do with working harder. It's working longer. And, you know, it's diminishing returns. And
then work hard, work smart.
Well, whatever. Obsessed with it. So I think the Dutch have a pretty good handle on that.
I'm not criticizing what the, you know, correct approach is. I'm certainly simply saying that if you want to establish what is, you know, a different work culture, that is somewhat at odds with the natural inclinations of the society, then, you know, you might have to attract a different kind of workforce, you know.
Okay, so more of reverse culture shock whenever I go to the U.S., of course, is always the size of things.
Like Cheesecake Factory food portions?
Sure, or just everyday things.
Just not criticism, by the way.
Like, oh, if you're gonna buy some oat milk.
Oh yeah.
It comes in a half gallon. And I'd never seen a half gallon carton of oat milk before.
Right. Because Americans have properly sized refrigerators.
Well, they have American sized refrigerators. Ours is sold, I guess, by the liter.
Yep.
And it's, you know, approximately half the size of a half gallon.
Yep.
And our refrigerators, that's because they fit into the refrigerators, the side door, which is made for half, for liter-sized things.
Yep.
And American refrigerators are made for half-gallon-sized things or larger.
Right.
So then it calls into question, like, how did that happen? Who's in cahoots with whom regarding the standardization of packaging sizes? Who's in cahoots?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yep, those are very interesting.
Who decided how wide the storage container, the storage shelving on the inside of your refrigerator door was going to be?
Right. I would strongly suspect that a lot of that, at least in the modern world, that thinking comes from the practical reality of grocery stores. And, you know, if you roughly think of whatever human adult sized shelves, and you know how many shelves you can get here, how much floor space there is, what are the break points in the shelves, you know, how tall do things have to be, how deep are they, and of course you can always deviate from those norms, you know, ideas of, you know, trade dress and that kind of thing. It's like, oh, I'm gonna put my, you know, exciting new product in a totally wacky package. It's like, all right, well, nobody's gonna, you know, if you can't get your thing onto Walmart shelves or whatever, then it's a non-starter. So I think a lot of it has to do with the kind of consolidation, the rise of supermarkets, and that's how most people get their food. And if you're just in if you have a mass market consumer item, that's where you're gonna sell your stuff. So there are constraints on packaging. I don't necessarily think that's a bad idea. I think if there were more similarities and hesitate to use the word standards because that's a little too top-downy for me. But if there are, you know, rough standards in the packaging game, then I think perhaps people would focus more on what's actually in the packaging. So you could potentially have, you know, side-by-side comparisons like, well, this, you know, product is whatever, more enjoyable than this one. And so I'm not going to make something, I'm not going to purchase something just because it fits in my refrigerator. Everything fits in my refrigerator. So now, you know, the onus is actually on the producers to make something that people genuinely want that's better than the competition. Anyway.
Well, and we also know from being in the reusable food packaging business that the tooling to make your own
yep.
wacky design is incredibly expensive.
Yep.
You know, and so all of these, this is again a very, very early days, but all of these reusable food packaging providers or manufacturers all have their own tooling. Every single size, every single variation costs about $100,000 to build the tooling to make that bowl or that cup or that plate. And most of the suppliers that we use have, you know, very similar sizes and shapes in terms of dimensions and volumes, but they're all a little bit different, and they're all just investing huge amounts of money hoping that they're going to be the ones that come out on top, I guess.
I think it is. Yeah. I mean, there are interesting elements, I think, of this doesn't apply to plastic so much, but if you think about things like, you know, your milk cartons or any product that could be in some sort of wax coated paper or some, you know, paper plus moisture barrier type thing, you know, you naturally have things like, okay, well, how did we get to the box, you know, the rectangular prism box? It's like, all right, well, you can have something that's flat, fold it this way or whatever, and then it works out and becomes this efficient, you know, as opposed to making things like spherical or cylindrical or something. That's your cylindrical things obviously don't pack as well on shelves, they don't pack as well, you know, in boxes, all that kind of stuff. So there's a, you know, the physical three-dimensional world that we live in has constraints on packaging, and you know, a lot of that filters down to the end product naturally.
Mm-hmm. I'm also noticing standardization on canvas sizes. So I brought this is why I was going to the US. I bought some artwork from this genius new artist painter, and I brought the paintings back with me, and now I'm noticing with the other artwork that we have, the canvas sizes are all pretty much standardized,
yep.
which is because of the frames and
making canvases before there's anything on the canvas.
And framing them.
And framing them, yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad idea, though. Of course, it does create its own issues. I mean, you know, we saw it too in our lifetime in terms of, you know, something like CDs, when that became the standard format, all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, you know, an album, whatever, back in the day, 37 minutes, maybe something like that, 45 minutes tops. All of a sudden, now you're like, oh, I got 74 minutes I got to fill up now. Now, of course, nobody has to fill up that amount, but all of a sudden it becomes the, you know, packaging, the format becomes this driver of the art or the product, and that's kind of unusual. I'm not sure it should be that way, but that's where we are.
Paul A. Young.
Yep.
Chocolatier closed all of his stores and the online stores as well. The best chocolates, best truffles I've ever had in my life, hands down. And they don't exist anymore.
UK chocolatier. Yes.
I would imagine I think, you know, probably didn't survive COVID. I think they shut down in 2023 after 17 years. I did a truffle making course there for fun. Very labor intensive, very expensive ingredients. I imagine that the profit margins were pretty thin, especially when you've got a shop in Soho.
Mm-hmm.
Still think it's really sad.
Yeah. I don't like, you know, it's interesting when institutions or, you know, very established brands have to stop doing business. I do think there are some fundamental issues with it. It's a luxury product, obviously, and nobody needs chocolate. So, but, you know, it's pretty dirty business in terms of, okay, well, where exactly does the cacao come from to begin with? Or the, you know, the nibs and all this stuff. And you're like, wait a second, are you making any of this in London? It's like, no.
Assembling.
No. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And I don't know if, you know, with these new advances that we have in, you know, hydroponics or even in, for that matter, meat, you know, cultured meats, that kind of thing. Are we actually moving to the place, you know, Western Europeans consume tremendous amounts of bananas, but I don't know if anyone's trying to focus on, say, well, apparently we fucking love bananas. It's like, can you make bananas, you know, more than a couple thousand miles away? It's like, well, we don't really, there's not much incentive to do that. It's like, we should probably focus on that. You know, we can grow something with anything now. We actually have, you know, fake sunlight, and if we can give the plants whatever they need, should probably be growing our bananas locally if we're going to eat so many of them.
I think it's just really, really hard, and the economics don't play out yet for anything that's not fast growing, which are herbs and lettuces.
Yeah.
So if you've got, you know, a cocoa tree or a banana tree or a coffee bean tree where it's not bearing fruit for a couple of years and it's an actual tree as opposed to a plant in some soil, it's really hard.
Yeah, but in terms of efficiency, you should probably be doing that in a lab anyway. I mean, that's where we're going with the cultured meats, yeah, that kind of stuff. There yet. No, but until, you know, whatever, a huge portion of the banana crop dies, or, you know, we talk about how tasteless our mangoes or avocados are here, avocado, that, you know, that we get in February or January. It's like, what do you mean I can't have a tasty mango?
Well, not tasty. They're not going to be
Northern
tasty.
Europe.
And they're coming from Brazil.
Winter time.
Yeah.
No, it's absurd. But it's like, why are we even bothering to fill the shelves of the grocery store with this tasteless nonsense? Just synthesize your mangoes or figure out a different way. It's like, oh, well, what are you doing? But that entire, you know, those poor island folks, they rely on us buying their bananas. It's like, they figure out something else. They should be eating their bananas, and we'll eat our bananas.
They rely on us keeping them in poverty by trying to bananas.
Yeah, exactly. It's like they'll figure out how to do things that will actually make it better for them.
So I don't think this is such an obscure factoid that Alex and Eddie Van Halen spoke Dutch.
Van Halen.
Eddie Van Halen.
I was going to say that's.
This is an interview from 1989.
Oh, yeah.
Wou in het land van de sinaasappels wonen, of de zon, weet je wel. Sinaasappels. Ze gingen naar Californië, want we hadden al andere familie die daar woonde. En ze zeiden het mooi steeds. En ze zeiden, ja, de vruchten van de bomen kan plukken. Yeah. En alles is heel goedkoop. Dan zijn we daar naartoe gegaan. En jullie vader zit ook in de muziek, hè?
So, what's funny is that, first of all, Eddie really looks like a Groninger. He's got the Northern Dutch chin and just the Northern Dutch sort
That's
of
like they are
profile.
From the north.
I don't know, but he looks like he's got that Northern profile that you see a lot. And Alex, who's older, at least my ear is detecting that his Dutch is a lot better than Eddie's, probably because he's older.
I think he probably spoke more of it.
Exactly.
And the parents did. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They both speak really quickly, but I think Alex's accent's a bit better. I think he's got a bigger vocabulary.
Yeah.
But that's crazy, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah.
And of course, Adam Curry speaks fluent Dutch too. So
Adam
probably,
Curry does speak fluent Dutch.
Yeah.
But that's just because of Patricia, whatever
no,
her name is, right?
He was born here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So they probably had some interesting conversations in the hairband days. And there's funny little secret language. Okay, I think we're caught up on those things.
I wonder if Wolfie speaks Dutch. Probably not. Oh, that's too bad.
I found this email in my inbox. I don't know how I got onto these mailing lists. We're going to go through this again.
What?
I got an email from Chris Krug. Crew.
Oh, Christ.
With an umlaut over the U.
Well, don't say real names.
I can. It's an email. Join our community of creative visionaries. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I was like, okay. How do you pronounce the U if there's an... It's crew as opposed to Krug, I guess. Like Motley Crue. Right?
I believe that's actually Motley Crue. It's got the umlaut on the O, too, doesn't it? Yeah. So, like, Motley.
Berlin. Yeah. Good. Okay. So, he's invited me to join his free online community of future-proof creative visionaries.
Sure.
On Discord.
It's very generous of him.
So he's letting me know that it's the new hotspot where art, AI, and ideas meet in an explosion of creativity. We've already got an inspiring crew of artists, futurists, and tech aficionados, sure. Various subgenres of creative badasses, Come say hello and see what we got going on, smiley face. Mm-hmm. So here are the job and or expertise profiles that he's seeking.
These are the folks. Oh, okay. This is what the network needs.
All so right. I'm going to go through all of these and you let me know if this is you.
I think all probably.
So
I'm sure it was a highly targeted email.
Are you a creative wanderer?
Nope.
Mind explorer?
Nope.
Musician?
No.
You're a musician.
No, I'm not a musician. I'll be the judge of whether I'm a musician. I'm self-identifying.
He's looking
here.
For
so, yeah.
Free souls?
Nope, definitely not.
Kinksters?
Nope.
Animal lovers?
Mm-mm.
Animal tolerators are not on the list. So
I might almost put myself. But okay, anyway, yeah, next.
Visionaries?
Nope.
Rebels?
Mm-mm.
Philosophers?
Nope.
Digital nomads?
Nope.
Echo warriors?
Uh-oh.
Futurists?
Nope.
Beat poets?
Mm-mm.
Abstract thinkers?
I don't think this one's for me. No.
Okay, what about this one? He's also looking for quantum punks?
Nope.
Glitch artists?
No.
Dreamers?
Nope.
Sola punks?
Mm-mm.
I don't know what a sola punk is.
I don't think it can be if I don't know what it is.
Hackers?
Nope.
Michael, are you maybe a retro futurist?
No.
Alchemist?
I would consider myself more of a future retroist. But no, I'm not neither one of those
you
things.
You are more of a future retroist. I would agree with that.
Oh.
Are you an alchemist?
Nope.
Whisperers?
Nope.
Crypto anarchists?
Nope.
Shamans?
Nope.
Interstellar voyagers?
Man, I don't think I'm the right person for him. Nope.
Storytellers?
Nope.
Psychonauts?
Nope.
And last but not least, he's looking for mystics.
Fingers are crossed on the last one, but
no,
that's not me
either.
I don't think
that this group is for you.
I don't think so. But how many of those apply to you?
Does abstract thinkers fall under the category of easily distracted?
No. He had something in there about wandering, right?
Oh, yeah. No. Creative wanderers or mind explorers. So if you were a mind wanderer.
Right.
But he's not looking for mind wanderers.
Or a creative explorer.
He's clearly either looking for creative wanderers or mind explorers.
Right.
Okay. So this, not for us.
And sorry,
then he says, why join? We're diving deep into the realms of AI, generative art, and cutting edge tools like Midjourney and ChatGPT.
Sure.
The conversations have been nothing short of mind bending, although mind benders are not on the list.
Interesting.
So DEI.
But if the conversations have been mind bending, I would say that everyone now is a mind bender.
DEI violation right there.
Yeah.
And I can't help but think how much more unique perspectives will elevate our discussions.
I think the problem is that he didn't mention blockchain. So I don't know how he can really be.
Blockchainers are not on the list. So.
No, I know. He's got crypto anarchists. So that's got to be something related to.
But to me, that just means tax evaders.
Right.
It's just a dog whistle.
Yep.
Storytellers, that just means liars. So, glitch artists.
Glitch artists, yeah. Yeah.
That just means you, when we test in production.
Yeah, I don't usually test my code, but when I do, yeah.
Hackers, that just means thieves.
I wonder if some of his
retrofuturist could be a steampunk. And I do like, I still, even though it's outdated, I still like sort of the
steampunk.
No,
but he didn't
aesthetic.
Say steampunk. He said quantum punk.
He didn't.
You can be a quantum punk, which maybe means that you're simultaneously a punk. Or if you're a, you know, a Schrodinger punk or something, you're both a punk and not a punk until somebody breaks the glass. And then you're
animal
dead
lovers.
Or
well, that could get a bit dicey.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Animal fuckers.
You see, but wait a second. I think he generated some of his terms maybe through ChatGPT. This is all a meta.
It could be. He could be mind bending us. Mind fuckers is not on the list because maybe that role has already been filled by him.
Right.
Musician seems very generic. It seems very in philosophers. That also seems in visionaries.
Yeah.
That seems very. And the other thing, too.
He doesn't have an adjective for those, right?
Well, in all of these roles that he's seeking, there's a gap. Now, I don't know if that's a typo or if the first dozen or so fall into a certain category,
sort of
category and the
right.
second dozen or so fill into its own category. It's not specified.
Yep, could be.
It could also just be space bar rebels or return key anarchists. Yep.
Might be that he didn't think about it too much.
He does list here shamans, not the shaman. So he's clearly
right.
not looking for new remixes of Born Slippy.
Shaman. Wait, that's Underworld, right?
Oh, yeah.
Shamans.
Sorry, shaman. Move shamans. Any mountains. Shaman, go move your mountains. Sorry about that. Yeah. Yeah, brain farters. Not on the list. So also not, I'm not qualified.
I think he wants your unique approach.
Well,
I hope he has plenty of folks joining him for his mind-bending conversations. Good.
So I have found outside somebody the who box can thinker. Teach and a group of women who want to be taught basic carpentry classes. And we're going to do that at a workshop in April.
Good.
I'm so excited. So now I'm thinking that maybe what I could do is learn how to make my own frames.
Mm-hmm.
She could teach us how to make a bar stool. So if I can learn how to make round edges and beveled edges and stuff, not a bar stool, but just a regular stool, like a three-legged stool.
3 points determine a plane.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
We have
good
a
old Euclidean geometry.
Busy day today.
Big fan of Euclid, are you?
Yep.
Yeah.
Huge.
That's good.
Euclid fans also not on the list.
What?
I know.
Huh.
I
what
know.
What about
shocking.
Pythagoras? Nope. The old Pythagoras? Big fan of him? Yeah.
Archimedes screwers? Not on the list.
Well, that disqualifies the Dutchies. They got nothing but Archimedes screws around here.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
That's it.
All right. Peace out, yo.